Hello and welcome to this podcast from Blackwell Online. My name is George Miller and my guest today is writer, journalist and filmmaker John Ronson. Having explored the world of extremists in Them and the wilder shores of the US military's psychic operations in The Men Who Stare at Goats, John has now turned his attention to psychopaths. Early on in his new book, The Psychopath Test, he writes, "I'd never really thought much about psychopaths, and I wondered if I should try and meet some. It seemed extraordinary that there were people out there whose neurological condition made them so terrifying, like a wholly malevolent space creature from a sci-fi movie. I vaguely remembered hearing psychologists say there was a preponderance of psychopaths at the top, in the corporate and political worlds, a clinical absence of empathy being a benefit in those environments. Could that really be true? I decided, no, it would be a mistake to start meddling in the world of psychopaths, an especially big mistake for someone like me who suffers from a surfeit of anxiety." Nonetheless, that is exactly what he does, and in doing so, explores society's attitudes to madness in a way which manages to be, in Will Self's words, both achingly funny and naggingly painful by making us think more deeply about our own attitudes. I began our interview by remarking that the FAQs on John's website explain that he gets many emails from people who believe themselves to be mind control victims, and make clear he doesn't want to get involved with investigating their cases. Did he expect a similar number of emails from psychopaths as a result of the new book, I wondered.
Well, an awful lot of them have already got in touch, both psychopaths, people who think they might be psychopaths, and people who think that their mother, husband, boss, whatever is a psychopath, have been swamped, actually. And once in a while, you get the sense that the person telling the story has got it wrong. And, well, for instance, if you're worried you may be a psychopath, that means you're not one, because psychopaths don't worry about being psychopaths, because in fact, being a psychopath, I presume, feels kind of great, because they don't have all the anxiety that we have and all the empathy. You know, all the things that make you be a good person are quite painful things. So not having any of those things can be a really good feeling. So those ones clearly aren't psychopaths. And then some of the people who say, I think my sister might be a psychopath or so, and you kind of feel, no, they're just using the book to sort of demonize people that they don't like. For instance, Sean Hannity was on Fox saying he's using my book to diagnose Obama as a psychopath. But yeah, a couple of the emails I've had have been incredibly compelling and very, very believable. One was a girl whose uncle had committed some, you know, terrible, violent crimes. And another was a girl whose sister, she described her sister, and it was incredibly compelling. And, you know, I don't really want to email back and say, your sister is obviously a psychopath, but, you know, if her description's right, then her sister obviously is. I'm slightly worried now I'm saying this that I didn't reply to her yet. Sometimes when I get a really important email, I tend to save it, and then I don't reply, I forget. So I think I might have done that with that one, and I've got the words, and as soon as this interview says, I'm going to look back and see whether, because it was a very emotional and powerful email.
This phenomenon you just mentioned about using that diagnosis as a psychopath to demonize someone you don't like, it's something you yourself have not entirely avoided.
No, in fact, the book became very much about that. I've noticed this in my books, and my books, I think, work best of all when I go through a kind of change. It's sort of what you expect when you read a novel. And I've always thought, well, why not expect it from non-fiction too? And in my first book, Them, I became a paranoid conspiracy theorist for a while. In The Men Who Stare at Goats, kind of nothing like that happened because I never started believing it was possible to kill a goat just by staring at it. But in this book, I really did. I went on a psychopath button course and totally turned into an incredibly adept and somewhat power-crazed psychopath then. And I write about that journey in the book. Hopefully it's a kind of cautionary tale. You know, don't do what I did, because I started diagnosing every girl, who I still actually have got my strong suspicions about.
You say very casually you're in a psychology department in London at the beginning. You said, I've never really thought that much about psychopaths, and I wondered if I should try to meet someone. Where did that desire spring from?
You know, it came from something that somebody had said to me a couple couple of years ago. It was a sociologist called Martha Stott, psychologist, and she just happened to mention that psychopathy was such a powerful brain anomaly that actually had remoulded society all along. That capitalism, at its most ruthless, was a manifestation of psychopathy. And that always stayed in my mind as just a huge thought. And I can never shake it. I always wanted to do something about that. It's kind of one of the biggest things that anybody had ever said to me. I didn't know whether it was true or not. So really, when I wrote that line, that's really what I was thinking, was it reminded me of that. Because to think of our society that we live in being powered by mental disorder as opposed to rationality, yes, it's just a huge thought.
And so I suppose one of the things we've always to do is to expand the common definition of what a psychopath is, because, you know, judging the films, it's the personality in the bushes with the life of a two-year-old child or whatever. And in fact, psychopathy is a much broader spectrum than that, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The way it's become accepted in this society is that it's a 20-point checklist. And if you've got 15 to 20 points, or even less really, even 12 or 30, that's it. You're a psychopath. And violence is really only accounts for one or two of the items on the checklist. One is poor behavioural controls, then there's impulsivity and irresponsibility, but those things don't have to be violent. What psychopathy basically is a clinical absence of empathy. And a lot of people who have no empathy at all don't never become physically violent, but always the psychopath hunters, they become malevolent. But their malevolent can be as a brutal boss or a manipulative, dislike type husband. But we all know a psychopath, and that's what the statistics lead you to. 1 in 100 people that we all, every time we go to a busy restaurant, especially if it's a busy restaurant in a capital city, because they do tend to, what's the asthma on the checklist I'm thinking of, need for stimulation, proneness, and boredom, they tend to go to London and New York and LA. So if you're in a big fancy restaurant in New York or LA, you're kind of bound to, be sharing a room with a psychopath.
Tell me about the figure of Tony, because he's a recurrent character. He's really one of the threads that you follow through the whole book. How did you encounter him, and what was your sort of inkling of his story?
There was a psychologist who introduced me to Tony. They wanted to prove to me that psychiatry was not to be trusted, that it was a pseudoscience. And they said, we can prove this to you by introducing you to Tony. He's in Broadmoor, and he faked madness to get out of a prison sentence. And now he's stuck, and the more he tries to convince the psychiatrist at Broadmoor that he's sane, the more they take it as evidence that he's crazy. So kind of like a real life McMurphy from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So they got me into Broadmoor to meet Tony. It was incredible actually to sit in the Broadmoor cafe called the Wellness Centre, trying to decide whether this guy sitting in front of me is mad or sane. It was a very odd, with the Scientologists, on the meeting.
If you said by the start, you found him quite plausible. You sort of more or less.
I mean, he seemed utterly, totally sane. He was wearing a pinstripe suit, and like the other patients at the Wellness Centre, who were all, docile and sweatpants and, shuffling. Yeah, he was none of those things. Not that sweatpants and docile shuffling, and I do not. Well, I do quite a lot of that. Especially when I put myself in pajamas. But you know what I mean. He seemed absolutely sane, and said, "I faked madness. Now I'm stuck. I faked it much too well, and now I'm completely trapped here." And it was very, very plausible. Anyway, it turned out I went to his clinician after leaving him. And the clinician said, "Yeah, it's true. We accept the story. We accept that he faked madness to get out of a prison sentence. However, we've assessed him." And we decided that what he is a psychopath, because faking madness is exactly the kind of cunning and manipulative act of a psychopath. The pinstripe suit too, that's glibness, superficial charm, and also grandiose sense of self-worth. So all the things that seemed sane about Tony were actually evidence according to his confession, that he was a psychopath. And that's really what led me on the journey.
And one of the big lessons that I took from the book journey was that madness sells in a society, whether it sells drugs, other treatments, whether it sells newspapers, advertising space, or daytime TV. As long as it's the right kind of madness, even in your own profession, and I suppose your book is a manifestation of that, really, isn't it? That we have a fascination with the troubled side of our own psyches, and it's part of the whole engine of our society.
Yeah, and in fact, we have a fascination with the troubled side of our own psyches, and for some of us, that's frightening, because we don't want to be mad. I think for other people, it's kind of glamorous, but I think for a lot of us, it frightens us. And so maybe that's why we enjoy the early rounds of The X Factor so much, because those people are madder than us, and it makes us feel a bit less out of control. Maybe it makes us feel better about ourselves. Yeah, I very much, after a year or so of writing this, it became very clear that I didn't want to write a book that didn't address the possibility that I was part of the madness industry. And you're right, even writing the book itself is part of it in a way. Things, if you just write a book, here's the problem, if you just write the book, that there are psychopaths among us, and you know, they're much more common than you think they are, and they're in positions of power, and in fact they might even remold society. I think all of those things are true. However, if you, and I think the book kind of proves this, and it's quite compelling at going into that. But if that's all the book's about, you're kind of writing a witch hunt. You're kind of saying, let's get him. And I started feeling very anxious, actually, about that. And I felt I needed to step out of that narrative and see what that meant in the kind of wider picture. So that's why the second half of the book is much more a kind of cautionary tale of, don't define people necessarily by their largest objects. Don't go and shove people into that box, because that can be just as bad.
I mean, well, the sort of physical manifestation of how much wider the stigma has become in this diagnostic manual called DSM that's gone through successive editions since the middle of last century, and each time the number of conditions goes up and up, and the book gets thicker and thicker and thicker. And again, it's a bestseller, so it's not just selling to clinicians, it's also selling to the general public, but it does show the sort of widening circle of what we as a society deem to be mental illness.
Yeah, it's now 886 pages long, DSM-4. The fourth edition. The fifth edition is coming out in about 2 years' time. And actually, my guess is that it's going to be reined in a little bit. I think DSM-4 might end up being the kind of apex of spotting madness everywhere. And I think we're beginning to calm it down a little bit. But I did meet the editor of DSM-3, and I asked him at one point whether there was any mental disorders he rejected in the various meetings where people would be shouting out proposed mental disorders. And he said, yeah, I did reject one. I rejected atypical child syndrome. He said the problem is when I said what are the overt characteristics, the person proposing it said, well, that's very hard to say because the children are very atypical. Well, I said to him actually, so okay, in fact, I don't know if I put this in the book, but I said to him then, so okay, if you find a disorder that just like 3 people in the world have, does that count? And he said, oh yeah, absolutely. So one's not enough. But 3 is enough.
But maybe if you create the disorder, the patients will come. Maybe that's what it says. And if it's in the book, then maybe we'll find them.
Yeah.
I also thought it was a fantastic moment in your interview with him. You could almost sort of imagine it on radio or on tape, where you ask him if you think, basically, you say, have they made mistakes? Mm. And tell me what happened in response to that.
Yeah, I said, do you think that in coming up with all these new disorders, you might have created a world in which normal behaviour was being mistaken for disorders? And he paused for quite a long time and said, I don't know. And then he paused a bit more and said, I don't like to think about it. And I said, why? And he said, well, because it means we would have made mistakes. Now, this is an industry. I'm not in any way anti him. I'm not in any way anti psychiatric. However, you are definitely seeing, a classic one is childhood bipolar disorder, where kids with temper tantrums, toddlers with temper tantrums have been labelled bipolar. So that's how far it's gone, especially in America. So, yes, there's no way that all the best intentions. And really, the creation of all these new disorders with a corresponding checklist was a response to Freudian psychotherapy, which was all about, you know, sort of mystical sleuthing. I know some people vehemently disagree with that, but it kind of seems to be like that. So it was all done for good intentions, but has clearly spoiled out of control, partly because the pharmaceutical industry has a kind of psychopathic desire to make as much money as possible.
One of the most fascinating chapters I thought was when you went to see a retired CEO who had been fantastically successful and ruthless in business. And basically you go through the checklist with him in order to see if this theory that you find psychopaths in other walks of life that are incredibly successful actually holds some water. And what I thought was interesting there was that lots of the characteristics which were basically negative on the questionnaire culturally could be flipped around and be seen as positive. So a certain degree of ruthlessness, focus, lack of empathy in the business world, those are things which in our culture, you know, have a certain amount of following, don't they? Yeah. So that's a sort of example of mainstreaming of the sort of psychopathic tendency, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I thought that interview was absolutely fascinating because, you know, this guy was extreme. He was an extremely ruthless CEO. However, he wasn't so extreme that he doesn't represent capitalism at its most ruthless. And there he was, exactly, just redefining the psychopath checklist as, you know, one of those management training, one of those management books, you know, who moved my keys.
Yeah. The interesting thing is he's not unique. As you say, it goes all the way down. It's not just the echelon of psychopathic CEOs. It's just sort of embedded in the whole business culture, isn't it?
Absolutely, and it's admired until you realise that it becomes this, you know, grotesque thing. You know, when you start to go to the towns that this guy, the CEO, I met, closed down, literally closed down an entire town to make more money for the shareholders, you know, you start to see it very starkly, you know, how dysfunctional psychopathic capitalism can be.
You mentioned your earlier books, John, and they've all been, I suppose, on the darker side or the extreme side of human behaviour. Do you have sort of decompression periods? Do you sort of come back to avoid getting the bends as you sort of come back into normal life?
No, because I really enjoy it. If I find a narrative that I really enjoy, I find it very enlivening, actually. I mean, I do like to travel, that kind of forces me, but the subject matter, funny, I don't find myself, if I'm being completely honest, I don't find myself getting kind of weighed down by the horror of the subject matter. What actually happens is that I get kind of enlivened and excited by the fact that I'm on a narrative journey that's intriguing to me, where there's a mystery to be solved. So that I always find so enlivening, that the horror, I mean, obviously, I mean, the other day, I met somebody whose daughter had gone missing just 3 months ago. So obviously in a situation like that, you know, you come on feeling, you know, you definitely feel weighed down by the kind of terrible sadness that's on the house. But when I'm on one of these kind of journeys for one of these books, I just feel so passionate and excited that's the thing that kind of propels me on.
John Ronson. The Psychopath Test is out now in hardback. You can find out more about all of John's books, plus several million others, by visiting Blackwell Online at blackwell.co.uk. You'll also find a podcast archive there with over 150 author interviews by clicking on the podcast tab on the home page. That's all for this edition of the Blackwell Online podcast, but I hope you'll join me again soon for another programme. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.